always waited.
College students and some of the growing ranks of the young unemployed were hired to wear the recreated uniforms and ride doped horses, and to carry some of the 100 or more Springfield carbines built especially by a firearms expert. They galloped, whooped, and fought out some of the most significant battles of the Indian Wars, from 1860 to 1890. A few local Indians took the chance of getting some drinking money by hiring on as Sioux or Apache, or whatever the script demanded from them. The one fight they avoided showing was, naturally enough, the Little Bighorn. But they did have a long blonde wig for someone to wear when they were doing the grand parade of cavalry heroes. You couldn't leave Custer out of that.
And the sky became black. The father of my father's father saw it. The rocks melted, and the desert became as glass. And the dead? Oh, my brothers, there were so many dead.
Nobody will ever know the full score of the megacull. But in the late 90s, I had some indirect dealings with MIT. That would be Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Experts there calculated that if only 1% of the Russians' missiles got through, it would take our economy several decades to get anywhere back to what might be termed normal, if it ever did get back. And they also concluded that, based on the same 1%, millions upon millions would starve in the first few months. Just 1% of the missiles. Nobody could know what happened back then. But it was surely more than 1%.
The museum hadn't been all that far away from some missile silos, and the area had been nuked with small, low-yield rockets, creating intense local damage, but not too much spillover. The hotspots cooled fast out in the desert. Shockwaves from Armageddon brought down the wall of the mesa, burying the United States Cavalry Museum. And so it remained for nearly 100 years.
Many of the people survived the first days of the attack. Our homes were often in remote canyons like this, well shielded from the great waves of power and the burning winds. The cities died. We went back to the ways of the old people. They were changed little, you understand. The long winters were not easy. There were bad times. The cold months of 3 and 4 years after the sky blackened. The Navajo caught a sickness, and their spirits did not save them.
Do you know why?
They had been close to the cities and the Anglo dead, places where spirits of darkness dwelled. They were touched, and they did not try the old ways. They were always in a hurry. They forgot that the cures that bring back the harmony and balance can take many days. They did not take that time. And in those 2 times of cold, the Navajo were almost destroyed.
What about us?
What of you?
Pink people like us. Is there many around here?
She means, Cuchillo Oro, were there any Anglos in these parts?
Yes. Few and poor, double poor. But we had no firefights with them, not for many scores of moons.
The Apaches, as their neighboring tribes declined, had taken over most of the hunting lands for a couple of 100 miles around. Secure in their healthy mountain fortresses, they had flourished, carrying on living in the old ways, hunting by their own knowledge, as they always had. They had spread their shadow clear across to the Canyon de Chelly. During the lifespan of those Mescalero alive during the brief time of the last world war, all was peace. A peace that lasted, according to Cuchillo Oro, until recent years.
First one and then two. Then a hand and then 2 hands. Anglos with blasters. Swift and evil men and women. They came from the north and the east, some from Mexilan.
What happened to the renegade whites when they came straying onto the lands of the Mescalero?
Cuchillo Oro slowly drew the great golden knife and mimed drawing it across his own throat. One of the squaws had just brightened the fire with dried wood, and the flames shone off the mirror of the broad blade. The war chief talked then of a time when the land had moved. He had only been a young man, barely in his teens. But he recalled the way that the earth had danced beneath his buckskin boots. The seismic disturbances had gone on for some months and were occasionally severe. The Apaches had called it the time when all men walked as if drunk. It had been a particularly bad shock that once again moved the earthslide that had covered up the United States Cavalry Museum, opening up the low roof of the single-story building as neatly as if it had just been built. But the Apaches hadn't known about this until some weeks later. There had been a group of renegade Anglos, traveling together on beat-up wags, moving slowly across the country. There were too many of them for the Apaches to take on in a direct firefight, but they monitored their progress. Cuchillo's father, Pony Rides Far, had ordered the young men of the Mescalero to keep clear of the whites. He did not want a confrontation that might risk anyone leading the armed killers back to Drowned Squaw Canyon. The whites had enlarged the museum, building themselves a crude replica of one of the old cavalry forts, near a bend in the river a quarter mile away from the tumbled mesa. For some years there had been a balance between the two groups. The Apaches lacked the firepower to hit the fort and the museum.
It was a mistake by my father. Man whose eyes see more urged him to attack the Anglos as soon as they came into our hunting lands. But Pony Rides Far wanted peace. For that wish, my father died. They caught him when his horse fell, and he... I will not talk of his passing, but they will be paid. One day, they will be paid.
Equally, the whites could find no way of taking on the Apaches in their Box Canyon. Twice they'd come out against the Mescalero, and twice they'd been beaten back with heavy losses. Cuchillo thought that one day they would come again, because there had been a change. After the uneasy years of quasi-peace, the Anglos had suddenly found a new leader.
Where'd he come from? I've got the feeling I've seen that bastard before, someplace, sometime, but I can't be sure.
No man knows. Some say he was found in a box of glass within the mesa, sitting astride his black stallion, frozen in time. And they woke him and he rides again for the pony soldiers.
Bullshit. Truth to tell, there was a moment when I wondered if we'd cron-jumped, seeing Otty Custer there, yellow hair streaming in the wind, like he'd just left Reno and Benteen and Miles and Keogh and the rest, and come like a grinning demon from Hades.
Ryan had never heard any of the names the Doc was mentioning, but he figured they had to be linked with this strange General Custer.
But I knew then he wasn't the real thing. There is something phonier than a $3 bill about him. You mark my words, friends.
Cuchillo could shed no light at all on the problem. All he knew was that things had become immeasurably worse since the appearance of the General. That was what his men called him. No other name, just the General. And he'd brought cunning and an iron discipline to what had been a bloody-minded rabble of mercies and hired killers. Now they all wore uniforms, had parades. Discipline tougher than it had been even in the days of the original 7th Cavalry, when there were more deserters than fleas on a dog.
We have fought with them in a dozen short firefights. Each time we have been beaten. They have taken prisoners from our young men, several. And then there is nothing. We see and hear nothing. They are taken and never return. It is as if the spirits have devoured them.
It was a fairly familiar story around the Deathlands. Not with the unique flavoring of the Cavalry Museum and the mysterious stranger with the blonde hair, but the tale of a local balance being upended by the arrival of a gang of guerrilla butchers. Often that was the way local barons arose, taking power with the blaster, then holding it by maintaining the balance of terror on their side.
So what are you going to do?
We have talked much of it. There have been councils with the old men. Our shaman has asked the spirits for help. But there is little hope. They're stronger than us. Unless there is some aid, we shall have to leave this place. It will be stained with blood.
Could be a way to beat the Sec men.
How?
I don't know, Cuchillo Oro. I don't know enough about them. Or you. But the trader used to say that you could always find a way.
Right. Over, under, around, or through. There's always a way.
The evening wore on. The moon drifted steadily across the top of the cliffs, showing the time to be approaching midnight. The fire was sinking. For at least a half hour, there had been no sound from the part of the camp where the Apache shaman was battling to save the life of the boy. Lori fell asleep on Doc's lap, sucking her thumb like a little girl. JB dozed, then jerked awake, grinning sheepishly at Ryan. Christy sat, elbows on knees, staring into the softly tumbling embers of the fire. Ryan sat quietly with his arm around her, occasionally asking Cuchillo Oro a question about the strength of the Sec men. Where did they ride on patrol? How many at a time? Did they have any grens? Guards around their fortress? he returned again and again to their leader.
I can tell you no more, Ryan Calder. It is late. Our sister the moon will soon be at her slumbers, and her brother will stir himself for a new day.
Yeah, I'm ready for bed myself. You say we can have that hut there?
Ryan pointed to a low-roofed shack to the left of the canyon.
Yes. You have seen many fights, Ryan Calder?
Too many.
Most against Anglos?
Anglos, blacks, women, muties, animals. You name it, and I guess I've fought it.
But you know the way of chilling men like these pony soldiers.
Some.
And your blasters. They are better. Better than what we have, and better than the Springfield carbines of the dog faces.
Cuchillo, you want us to throw in with you against Yellowhair and 50 or more sec men? If that's what you want, then let's have it out on the table so we can all see it.
There are three of you, if I count the old man.
Five, mister.
But only JB and me got blasters that'd be much use.
Cuchillo Oro rose to his feet.
The people do not beg for help, Ryan Calder.
I don't expect you to beg. I'll talk to the others about it first thing in the morning and let you know what we decide.
This land
is... Your land. I've heard that before, Cuchillo Oro. I told you. I'll let you know. Right now, I'll go look at the kid and see if...
There is no need. His son, Lifegiver, aided me in my work.
Man whose eyes see more stood behind them, naked above the waist, eyes hidden behind an antique pair of mirrored sunglasses. He looked drained and frail.
Is Jack...
He will live.
Dawn tiptoed over the crest of the towering cliffs at the head of the canyon, above the pool of calm water, spilling down in a cascade of golden pink light. Ryan had snatched 3 hours' sleep, waking early and crawling from under the pile of musty blankets, leaving Christy, JB, Lori, and Doc still dozing. Man whose eyes see more was lying on a disgustingly dirty old mattress at the side of the bed where Jack was resting, out in the open air. The shaman was reading a cracked and faded old book with a torn cover. Ryan could just make out that it was called Backflash. It seemed to be a kind of future fic book, back in the days when people thought that there would be a future. The shaman ignored his presence. Jack's eyes creaked open, and he looked up, showing the pale pink coloring. The shaman had brushed through the long white hair, removing the tangles and burrs, cleaning out the orange dust. With his albino coloring, Jack never looked anything that remotely approached healthy. But now he looked more like a bathed corpse resting on its funeral bier. The skin, taut across the sharp cheekbones, was almost transparent, but the thin smile was still Jack Lauren.
Oh, bastard tired, Ryan. Feel like being on a long journey. Tired, but ready to kick ass, huh?
If you feel as bad as you look, then you should have been nailed in the long wooden box a week ago.
Thought I was gone, Ryan.
I thought so too, son.
Ryan looked at the shaman.
How'd you do it?
What?
Bring him back.
It is true that he was already walking with the spirits, but he wished to return to this world.
Most small settlements like this would have had a number of stark-ribbed mongrels, scavenging and fighting for scraps, but there wasn't an animal in the canyon, except for the string of ponies tethered near the water. The sun was creeping higher, and Ryan could begin to make out the texture of the sheared rocks above the pool. It was part of his fighting instincts to always make sure he knew where the exits lay. As far as he could see, Drowned Squaw Canyon didn't leave a man much choice. The cliff seemed to rise almost vertically, with no obvious holds for a climber. The Apache watched him from behind the silver reflective lenses.
No man ever made it.
The rocks?
Yeah. There's old Mescalero stories about a time we were attacked by a bunch of Cheyenne looking for new hunting lands. They tried a trick and set fire to the canyon floor. There was a young man called Wings on Feet who was supposed to have gotten up there and hauled up the whole tribe. Then they looped around the Cheyenne, or it could have been Comanche, and drove them into their own trap.
You believe that?
I believe in the old magic, Ryan Calder. I have the power. I can see. I can heal. I've seen things you people wouldn't believe.
I've seen you bring the boy back from the wrong side of death. I believe you.
He has broken ribs, and there was another thing wrong with him. That is now well. He must rest for 3 or 4 days. I have strapped his ribs for him.
Now, Feels tighter than a clam's ass, but doesn't pain.
Good to see you, Jack. Take it real easy now.
Ryan?
Yeah?
Hate firefight. Who? Not them here. Who?
Sec men, Jack. But it's kind of a long story. Get man whose eyes see more to tell you.